I'm Sam Cedar, and I have an announcement to make. No, I'm not retiring. Sorry. And no, Donald Trump has not had a stroke. Again, apologies. No, it's good news, which is not to say that some of those other things I just mentioned might not be good news, but this is a different type of news. We're launching a new podcast. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Sam, what's wrong with you? The Majority Report puts out more content every week than I can listen to now. Are you insane? Well, the answer is, you may be right. I may be crazy, but it just might be a lunatic you're looking for. Forget that. Sorry. The point is, the new show is going to be short. It's going to be a morning show that basically gives you the top stories to watch out for throughout the day. It'll be quick, super quick, like a quickie. In fact, we're calling it Majority.fm's AM Quickie. Now I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Sam, are you insane? How are you going to do two shows every day? Who's going to feed your kids breakfast when you have custody of them? How are you going to prep for the Majority Report? Well, the answer is Lucy. In fact, Lucy Steiner. Lucy, are you here?
Hi, Sam.
Hi, Lucy. Lucy Steiner, ladies and gentlemen. Lucy is a comedian who worked with our very own Brendan on a political comedy show that sadly never launched. She's funny and smart, and I know you're going to love hearing from her when I'm tied up with the kids in the morning.
Ah, thanks, Sam. We're launching the show Wednesday of this week. It'll be live in the Majority Report feed for the first few weeks, so you won't need to do anything extra to find it. Eventually, we're hoping to have it posted in the morning every day by 8:30 a.m., but that might take a while.
That's right, folks. You know the routine. We'll drop something in the feed tomorrow morning to get you ready for Majority.fm's AM Quickie. Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you, Sam.
And now for the Majority Report.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It's Wednesday, July 10th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks, and on a Michael Wednesday, this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Lauren Rogers, Executive Director of the National Center for Employee Ownership, discussing a new piece in the New Republic, An Economy in Waiting, Fighting Inequality by Turning Workers into Owners. Discussing that with him. Nancy Pelosi continues the non-resistance by joining with Mitch McConnell in deferring to Trump on Acosta's future, as calls for the labor secretary that gave once convicted human trafficker, Jeffrey Epstein, a horrifying sweetheart deal several years ago. But it's Trump's pick. It's his labor secretary, apparently. Migrant children were in overcrowded Arizona border station and have alleged abuses ranging from sexual assault to physical abuse. Attorney General Barr won't recuse from Epstein prosecution, but will remain uninvolved in any review of a past plea deal. And federal judge rejects Trump administration's bid to swap out lawyers for a census case on citizenship question. Iran welcomes France's efforts to save some form of the Iran deal. Israeli education minister calls intermarriage rates for U.S. Jews a second Holocaust and a strong rebuke of those that would cheapen the term concentration camp by using it to describe detaining children at the border. Sergio Moro, Brazil's justice minister, after his rampant bias and corruption has been exposed in the political imprisonment of Lula da Silva and more, he's taking a temporary leave from his position as the fallout from that scandal, that mass exposure, reverberates in Brazil. Bizarre story, Democratic donor Ed Buck, who has had two African-American men die in his home of crystal methamphetamine overdoses in the last 18 months. He's now getting accused of human trafficking and revenge porn. Extremely bizarre story, which already was basically a rebuke to black male lives, if you look into it, at least in my opinion. And the UK ambassador to the US has resigned after his quite accurate assessments of the Trump administration have been released. The appeals court looks skeptical of Obamacare. A panel of Republican justices there, and a North Carolina law signed by a Democratic governor will allow drug dealers to be prosecuted with murder. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Three of us are here. Brendan might need to step out early to get to Philly.
It's going to be down to just two of us.
It's going to be down to just two of us. We've actually done that before, Matt.
We've done that many times.
We have definitely pulled off the two-step very well before. So yesterday we talked about Tom Steyer getting into the race. I mean, I think stylistically, one of the reasons that it's so maddening is he actually does. I mean, he really does. I didn't think of it yesterday on this show, but when we were talking about last night on TMBS, he does remind me of Marty Funkhauser in Curb Your Enthusiasm. And that actually, in a way, he has a likability that none of the other sort of equivalents in his lane remotely possess, right? Like Howard Schultz, delusional, oligarch, unlikable, nothing positive to say for him. Steyer seems like kind of the out-of-touch boomer liberal on steroids that have been banned in the United States, right? Like, but that actually adds to how maddening it is, because it's like, you know, in Schultz's case, there's oligarchy, there's delusion, and then there's the fact that this really is just a self-interested class warrior fighting to protect a position that he thinks is under attack. Tom Steyer is coming out in his announcement yesterday and basically saying, oh, no, I'm not just a delusional hedge fund billionaire. I am the progressive champion. Which, and on some level, I think he actually believes that. Bernie Sanders was asked about this by Andrea Mitchell yesterday, and I think he spoke for a lot of us in terms of not just his feelings about Steyer, but really the whole systemic problem that Tom Steyer's candidacy represents.
Now we have a new candidate in the race, Tom Steyer, the billionaire who's made a cause of impeachment. What do you think about him entering the race with all of his money?
Well, you know, I have known Tom for a number of years, and I like Tom personally. But I do have to say, as somebody who in this campaign has received 2 million campaign contributions, averaging, I believe, $19 a person, I am a bit tired of seeing billionaires trying to buy political power. So I like Tom. He is a good guy. He's a friend of mine. But I'm not a great fan of billionaires getting involved in the political process.
So he should not be taken seriously as a candidate, you think?
No, I didn't say that. Look, if you are a billionaire by definition, you are taken seriously. But I think the American people understand that one of the great problems facing American society today is that we have a billionaire class which is getting richer and richer, while the working class of this country is struggling and, in fact, has been decimated over the last 45 years. And people are sick and tired of big money in politics. People want to overturn Citizens United. In my view, we've got to move to public funding of elections. Billionaires, and this is not just Tom Steyer, billionaires should not be able to spend unlimited sums of money trying to buy elections.
Well, I mean, of course, he's absolutely right. And I, you know, the only possible upside from people like Steyer running is to make exactly that point about the systemic challenge, the systemic problem, the systemic undermining of democracy that having that level of wealth creates inherently. No matter how well-intentioned you are, no matter how much you think you're a nice person, no matter how much you might even be on the right side of some important issues. And then, of course, the other thing with Steyer, and I really would recommend that in a respectful way, it does not have to be super sarcastic or polemical, but you can be responding to all of the social media accounts with like, hey, you know, hey, Tom, thanks for your interest. Here's a great project that would be way more helpful than you running for president. Here's something on gerrymandering. Here's something on local elections. Here's something on state court races. Here's a, you know, a initiative on the environment. Here's any number. I mean, we said it yesterday. The literally millions of ways in which you could benefit this country and this world instead of just a delusional narcissistic exclusion. And the bigger point, right, is like, well, no, he's a billionaire, so he will be taken seriously. And, you know, that's a systemic problem. Nobody's going to just say, you know, who is the New Jersey State Public School Teacher of the Year? I don't know. Right? And nobody's saying we should find that person and they should run for president. I don't think it's such a disanalogy at all. I mean, there's no reason why in any healthy functioning society, why that background would be an automatic launching point of a presidential campaign.
This is what billionaires running for office sounds like.
I alone can fix it.
That's exactly right. That's right. And that is the through line of the demagogue, the clown fascist, of the, you know, of the Starbucks delusion. And yeah, Steyer too. Because at the end of the day, that is the, I'm the one who can magically do this stuff, even though I have no experience, no context, no grassroots base. Well,
no,
why?
No coalition.
No coalition, no organic anything. Well, I have money, and that sort of magically confers competence. Now, we're going to play one more Bernie clip before we get to the interview, because this was actually another thing that was incredibly important yesterday, announcement that Bernie Sanders and AOC are teaming up to introduce a climate emergency in Congress. Climate is, in fact, an emergency. There is a global ecological crisis. And this is the type of energy that's going to need to be harnessed in and outside of Congress to really make the aggressive interventions that are necessary. And, of course, this is some pretty good vintage. I don't know whether he's outside of D.C. or maybe he's in Burlington, but Bernie threw on the polo.
It's a nice day.
It's a nice day.
Enjoying myself with my smoothie. No, that's not a smoothie.
Shelling in Cedar Rapids. All right, let's check this out.
This morning I introduced legislation in the Senate declaring that climate change is a national emergency. Similar legislation was introduced in the House by Representative Blumhauer and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Anybody who does not appreciate that climate change is a not only national emergency, but a global emergency, really does not understand what's going on. And what the scientific community has told us is that we have all of 12 years in order to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy, or there will be irreparable damage done to this planet. Our job right now is to have the courage to take on the fossil fuel industry, who make billions and billions of dollars every single year destroying our planet, to take them on and, in fact, to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. This is a national emergency. The future of the planet is hanging on our decision about moving forward. Let's go forward together. Thank you.
I also, you know, I love the consistency that every single message is really defined by the basic conflict and the stakes. And the conflict of the stakes is the fossil fuel industry, their asymmetry of their power relative to the rest of the process. Until that's corrected, you're not going to have serious action on this, regardless of the scientific conversation, regardless of even really effective and necessary public persuasion. Fundamentally, if you don't take on that concentration of power, you are not going to have the necessary action that's required at all. And I would say just one other thing, too, that with regards to the broader conversation about climate and why it's not just sufficient to sort of argue about whether or not you, quote unquote, accept the science. When the right wing accepts the science of this, their answers are going to be apartheid-like and authoritarian. So like, okay, yes, there's shrinking resources. There's already resource wars. We're going to have conflicts over water. Okay, let's make it another.
Let's build a wall.
Let's build a wall. Let's get money. Let's get essential resources to a narrow set of constituencies and people. It's fundamentally a political conflict, and that's how he's framing it. It is an emergency, and I love it. It's important. All right. We are going to take a brief break, and then we're going to come back with Lauren Rogers. He's executive director of the National Center for Employee Ownership. This is the Majority Report.
We break into mobile homes. We go to sleep to shake a pill. Never wake up on our own. And that's the way we get by. The way we get by. All that's the way we get by. The way we get by. We go out in stormy weather. We seek out the taciturn. And that's the way we get by. To the way we get by. All that's the way we get by. To the way we get by. That's the way we get by. To the way we get by. To the way. That's the way we get by. That's the way we get by. We found a new kind of dance in a magazine. Try it out, it's like nothing you sweet talk like a cop, you know it. You bought a new bag of pots, so let's make a new start. And that's the way to my heart, to the way to my heart. And that's the way we get by, to the way we get by. And that's the way we get by, to the way we get by, to the way. And that's the way we get by. And that's the way we get by.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Lauren Rogers, Executive Director of the National Center for Employee Ownership. Lauren, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure, Michael. Happy to be with you.
So, Lauren, let's start really simple here. When we talk about employee ownership, what specifically are you talking about in the context of the work you do?
Sure. There's a spectrum of employee ownership in the United States. Here, the sort of the core of the employee ownership world is something that sounds a little arcane. It's called an employee stock ownership plan, or an ESOP. It's a federal retirement plan for a quirky reason of history, and it's pretty big. It's got about 6,000 companies, privately owned companies, another 1,000 that are in publicly traded companies. Covers about 2.8 million people if you just look at privately held companies, and they've got about $130 billion in stock in their companies. These ESOPs, the employees own anywhere from 0.5% to 100% of the business. Right now, the most common percent is that the employees own the whole company through an ESOP. There are other forms of employee ownership. One is what people probably think of most often when they think of employee ownership is a worker cooperative.
Right.
And the United States has a long-standing history in worker co-ops. There are about 450 worker co-ops in the country. About 7,000 people work for them. And they're doing pretty well. They generate about $500 million in revenue every year. So they're doing great.
And also the another example of worker co-op sort of at a scale would maybe be the Mondragon region in Spain as an example.
Yeah, that's okay. Right. They okay. are people call them the mecca of employee ownership. They're a huge 82,000 employee set of companies. They're a whole family of companies, and they're all democratically governed, owned by their workers. And they produce everything from dishwashers to running a retail outlet to high-end racing bicycles. They're all over.
And so in the United States, what are some companies? You said, yeah, so there's close to, and I'm quoting now from an article by John Case, your colleague in the New Republic. It's that close to 7,000 U.S. businesses are partially or wholly owned by a trust known as Employee Stock Ownership Plan, or ESOP, which you just outlined. And some of these companies, where what are some examples of ones that are actually majority employee owned? As an example, could you talk a little bit about New Belgium Brewing and maybe also the W.L. Gore and Associates?
Yeah, of course. Those are two fabulous companies. New Belgium Brewing makes Fat Tire beer. They've been doing this for an awful long time, and they've been one of the successful figureheads of our movement. They often speak at events. They're one of the companies that a lot of other companies emulate. And in fact, having New Belgium in the craft beer brewing business has led to, well, I shouldn't say led to, but they're part of the movement in the craft brewing world. So there are a whole lot of employee-owned craft brewers now. So we've got a whole bunch of them. Harpoon Brewing in the East Coast and the Boston area, a whole bunch of them. One thing that's interesting about New Belgium is that they're a really interesting combination of a very business-focused business. You know, they do open book management. So everybody at New Belgium understands the profit and loss statements. They're all engaged in making the business as successful as it can be. But they're also really thoughtful about kind of the high touch, high end sort of human element of business. So they get everybody involved in the mission and the values and kind of the rituals of being an employee owner at New Belgium. You mentioned Gore-Tex. So W.L. Gore is the company that makes Gore-Tex, and they're one of the most creatively structured companies out there. They have self-organizing work groups. So if someone, W.L. Gore employee, has a great idea, she tries to recruit colleagues to join her in this project. And if she does, then it happens. And if she doesn't, it doesn't. Hmm. It could be that the great idea comes from somebody who's fairly new, and it could be that the president or the manager of a location joins that team and reports to the new person. So they're very flexible and very focused on projects and getting things done.
And so what is the history specifically of ESOP legislation going back to the 1970s? How does this become, and I guess, you know, okay, obviously somebody can go and set out and create something like a food co-op, and you can structure a business in a certain way. And you know, you could potentially structure it as a nonprofit or various other kind of forms of ownership models, but this specific model of employee ownership actually has a long history of federal legislation behind it. What is that history going back to the 1970s?
It does, and if you don't mind, we step back just a little bit further.
Go anywhere you want.
All right, let's go to 1956 then.
Okay, great.
That's the year that the first ESOP was created in the United States. It wasn't called an ESOP at the time, but it's the same model. And that was a newspaper company in the Bay Area. And at that point, there was, as you said, Michael, there was no federal legislation to support this. So if you wanted to create an ESOP, you had to go to the IRS and say, here's what we'd like to do. Can we do this? And, you know, sort of a case-by-case permission. So as you alluded to, something big happened in the 1970s, which is that the Congress passed the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, lovingly called ERISA, and that set up a framework where any company could meet some minimum requirements set up by the federal government, and if they did that, they could create an ESOP. You know, the ESOPs are still oversight by the Department of Labor and the Internal Revenue Service to make sure everything's done as it should be. But it's got a lot easier to make an ESOP then. So the number of ESOP companies went from about 200 that had accumulated over the prior two decades to where they are now, which is 7,000 companies with ESOPs. And what ERISA did is it made, well, it was a creature of Congress. So it combines a whole bunch of different goals, some of which appeal to Republicans, some of which appeal to Democrats. So everybody was, in the 70s, was trying to make sure American business could really compete with Japan. You might remember the scare in the auto industry. So the idea of employee ownership was partly to make American businesses more competitive. It was partly to create a new source of retirement wealth for ordinary working people. And it was partly to directly address the stratification of wealth. The people who came up with this was an investment banker named Louis Kelso. his explicit idea was that no working person is ever going to keep up in the modern economy unless he or she owns a piece of companies, because companies are what ultimately generate wealth in our business. And if people are excluded from the ownership, from the success, share of the success of those companies, there's no way they're going to keep up. And so,
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, that's interesting, because that's actually one of the, I mean, we'll speak more broadly in a couple minutes, but my, you know, sort of my democratic socialist instincts are very excited by the idea of, you know, obviously of companies being democratized. And, you know, a company like New Belgium, I was already actually familiar with through Professor Richard Wolff's work, and how, you know, how dynamic and how exciting that is. And actually, and then I think, you know, that actually kind of spills into a broader conversation of, could this model also have broader ancillary effects, right? So that in addition to the innate and primary goal of enhancing, you know, sort of, you know, earnings, retirement security, and so on, could this also have other effects on decision making in a company in terms of, you know, environmental goals or other social impacts? Actually, maybe can I just ask you that more broadly before we get back to the specifics? Would that also start to come into the analysis at some point, that if companies start to have a broader set of stakeholders, that might potentially translate into a broader set of systemic thinking about, you know, businesses' impact on the community or the environment, and so on?
Yeah, absolutely. That ends up being a really subtle and fascinating question, Michael. I'm really glad you asked that. There are a number of our companies, of our member companies. King Arthur Flour is one good example. They set themselves up as kind of it used to be a unique thing, but it's getting more common. A company that is both 100% owned by its employees and a B corporation. So they've got a commitment to a triple bottom line of environment, social, and business success. And there are a number of our companies that do that. There's a really nice fit between being employee-owned and being a benefit corporation.
What is a benefit corporation? Could you just elaborate on that for a second?
Yeah, a benefit corporation is a form of business organization where companies amend their bylaws. In 37 states, there's state law provisions that encourage this, so that they aren't focused exclusively on shareholder value. They're looking at other stakeholders so that they can also bring in environmental concerns and social concerns.
Great. And sorry, I interrupted your flow there. What was the second point you were going to make?
Yeah, the second point is that that there is a lot of bringing in other values. Some of those values, though, are from the right end of the political spectrum. I mean, the person who's most directly responsible for ESOPs was a Democratic senator, Russell Long. Mm-hmm. He was a Southern Democrat.
Right.
And, you know, he had deep conservative
sure
roots.
Was.
And,
yes.
Yeah, exactly,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So he was really excited about employee ownership as a way to combat the stratification of wealth, a good democratic liberal idea. But he was also really excited because he's got some real market values, too. And like a lot of Republicans who support employee ownership now, he saw employee ownership as a great way to build a capitalism that has more capitalists, just a more robust capitalism that would really get capitalism and the benefits of capitalism to a bigger piece of the population. So I think what we see is a bunch of our member companies are like King Arthur Flour or New Belgium, and they do things that really engage in the communities, that take social and environmental concerns into account. But a number of our other companies come to this from values which aren't tied to the left, but other values that may be tied to the right end of the political spectrum. And so we've got some companies that are defense contractors. We've got some companies that manufacture supplies for I'm not sure the right way to say this, but they're specifically Christian supplies. So if you get a tchotchke that your church gives out or something like that, it might be made by an employee-owned company. So what's interesting about employee ownership, and I hope that you and your readers leave this conversation not exactly knowing which side of the spectrum I'm on personally, is it's got a really strong root in both the left and the right.
So, and that's, and I think that is, that's actually, I appreciate the clarity for the purpose, because, you know, obviously this is a show certainly on the left, and I think it's helpful to understand actually that, and one of the things that's exciting about this is that it, to me, I mean, look, if you already had a more broadly democratized economy where more people were doing better across the board, that's already a better place to be having an argument and a debate from to begin with, right? Like, absolutely. That's already a significant upgrade. So that I'll, you know, defend innately. And then I think, you know, that's an important question. I think obviously a lot of people, you know, in this program would say, well, no, it couldn't, you know, the goal would not to have, you know, not to be a, you know, communally owned, you know, defense contractor would not be the upshot of many people in this audience, obviously, because there's, you know, broader concerns about, you know, well-being of people across the planet and so on. But I think that that's a, but is it, I understand it makes total sense that there would be companies that identified with more sort of on the conservative side of the spectrum that would want to, you know, bring in a broader sense of, you know, I said stakeholders, they could say stockholders, in fact, right? But in terms of politics right now, and I don't want to make the, I'm not trying to get you to be partisan. I just want to talk specifically right now in terms of who is working legislation or talking about ideas on the campaign trail that would support this model. So I know that, you know, Bernie Sanders is an example, actually going back to his time as mayor of Burlington, was extremely supportive of these types of enterprises and helped actually, you know, set up co-ops in Burlington. I know that there's legislation. I know there's one version of the Labour Party in the UK, and I think Bernie's introduced similar legislation, which I'd like to ask you about first, which would basically, the government would give bridge loans to medium-sized companies if the workers wanted to absorb them. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, the Bernie has not spelled out the details of what he would do. He's got several different pro-worker ownership proposals right now, and you're absolutely right. He's been one of the longest-term, most active supporters of employee ownership. I was going to say in the Senate, but it's even bigger than that. He's one of the heroes of employee ownership. And Vermont has more employee ownership per capita than just about any state in the country. So there's a good reason that he's a good reason and a good effect of all that Senator Sanders has done. So in terms of his proposals, some that are most exciting, I think, are he's talked about setting up a worker ownership bank, which would facilitate the transition of conventionally owned businesses to worker cooperatives or ESOP ownership. That's a fabulous idea. The idea of his that I'm most excited about is the idea of setting up a state employee ownership center in all 50 states. Because when I look at this field and I see what's holding back the creation of more employee ownership, it's mostly about marketing. Because if you think about it, the main time that a company becomes employee-owned is when somebody set up a business, they own it all themselves, they're getting close to retirement, they're trying to decide who's going to own their business after them. And they can choose. They can decide to sell it to somebody in the family if there is somebody like that. In most cases, there's not. They can decide to sell to a competitor or a public company in their field. They can choose to sell to private equity or some other holding company, or they can sell to their employees. And a lot of people think that selling to their employees is great, but they don't get quite across the finish line. And that's because, in my opinion, there's so much money right now. Money is so cheap. Private equity firms have a huge amount of money. Public companies have a huge amount of money. They're looking to use it productively. And one way they do that is by acquiring these fabulous businesses that otherwise would be great candidates for employee ownership. And I think that's actually another place that the left and the right come together. Obviously, anybody on the left would rather see Wall Street not own these firms. And I think a lot of Republicans are there as well. They like the idea of Main Street ownership. So I think that's another place we can all.
Would you say in term, and I would include, by the way, a lot of Democrats here, frankly, you know, who take money from, you know, financial services. When you're talking about, you know, I could totally see a large part of Republican voters liking the idea of mainstream ownership as an example. But, you know, you have some examples. Yeah, obviously, Sanders is a leader. I want to talk about Warren's corporate board seats in a second. And you've actually point out that actually Klobuchar and Gillibrand have sponsored some helpful things in regards to this as well. Is there any Republican? I totally on a business and grassroots sense makes total sense. Is there any Republican legislatively that's working on this right now? That's sort of in support of this in a constructive way in Congress?
Yeah, there are. Okay, I'd say the biggest hero of the last. Senate is Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. She was the moving force behind creating the first major legislative success around employee ownership in a decade, the Main Street Employee Ownership Act.
What did that do?
That encouraged the Small Business Administration to create more employee ownership in two main ways. One was by extending SBA guarantees to loans that are used to transition a business from conventional ownership to employee ownership. And the second is by starting to use the whole outreach apparatus of the SBA, and they've got a lot of them, to spread information about employee ownership so that business owners learn about it as an option. I see it as a great new source of information that's pushing the other way than all the marketing done by private equity firms. So that is Senator Gillibrand is the person who should get the credit for that. But she did bring on a Republican co-sponsor who was very eloquent and very engaged in the process. That's Jim Risch of Idaho. And at our last conference, we had our conference in Pittsburgh, and we had about 1,900 people. So both Senator Gillibrand and Senator Risch gave video welcomes to our attendees there. And Senator Risch isn't the only one. There are folks in the House who've supported employee ownership as well from both sides of the aisle.
What about the idea of Elizabeth Warren's idea of employees elected on corporate boards? In terms of how does this kind of how would that play into it?
That is, I'd say that's sort of a cousin idea.
Okay, got it.
She has separated the board seat from actual ownership by employees. And so she's thinking more of the kind of German co-determination model where people just by virtue of being employees have a right to a role in corporate governance. I'd say that's a separate issue. And in my mind, what's much more important is the actual ownership. It's governance matters, of course, but I think that when ownership actually changes hands, then you don't just get a change in the types of decisions that a company makes. You also get a change in the criteria by which companies make decisions and for whom they make decisions. So in my mind, having a minority of the board be appointed by the employees is far less important than having ownership by employees, because ownership by employees is a system change. It rewires the decision-making process inside a company.
So just I want to get to in a couple of minutes or in a minute, you'll talk about how candidates should run with this, which is also, I think, part of the John Case's article that we're kind of referencing here. But let's talk. Could you explain the United? I didn't know about this. The United Claps. And
sure.
How did this ESOP? How did that get tied into United Claps? And how did that potentially, and obviously you would say incorrectly, sort of cloud people's perception of this?
Yeah, United Airlines is one of the spectacular failures of employee ownership, unfortunately. And interestingly, I think the best way to look at that is an airplane analogy, which is that journalists cover it when a plane crashes, but they don't cover all the safe landings. And most ESOP stories are kind of not that interesting stories of companies people haven't heard of, just doing well.
Right.
United Airlines, what went wrong was partly a result of timing. They put their ESOP in place in 1994, and it was a result of it was the initiative of the pilots union, and they worked really hard. It was the second time they had tried to create an employee ownership plan at United. This time they succeeded partly because they recruited the machinists union and the non-union employees to join them in creating the ESOP. And they ended up, collectively, those three employee groups ended up with 55% of the shares of United, and the other 45% of the shares were still traded on the New York Stock Exchange. And there were a couple problems with it that doomed it, maybe not from the beginning, but there were a couple problems. One is that the flight attendants union never bought on. There's a really intricate soap opera union politics story behind it, but the flight attendants are the face of the company to most United customers, and having them not involved was pretty crucial as a mistake.
Right.
There was also a really quirky way the United ESOP was designed, which is that it was sort of built with a self-destruct button. It lasted 10 years, and then it was designed to start fading away. Most ESOPs, when we do surveys, 83% of our members say they intend to be permanently employee-owned, but that wasn't the case at United because of the way they set it up, because of the intricate finances behind the transaction. And then the biggest problem with United was 9/11, those planes crashing into the World Trade Centers,
right.
Caused several airlines to go bankrupt. It didn't right. matter how well the airlines were run. But, you know, United was the one employee-owned airline that went bankrupt, and people point to that sometimes as a failure of employee ownership. But there are plenty of airlines that were investor-owned that went bankrupt, and people don't indict investor ownership. So I think there's a right. double standard going on there.
All right. Yeah, that sounds exactly right to me. So if I'm guessing, if you were to advise candidates, you would say, hey, Senator Sanders, do an ad that connects, you know, the great proposals you're putting forward today that you outlined earlier on and then go back to these companies you helped get off of the ground, and you were mayor in Burlington, and go do photo ops at employee-owned companies like New Belgium. Hey, you know, Senator Gillibrand, you need to, raise the profile of your campaign. Talk about this great legislation you co-sponsored in 2018. Do you think that this can be used to center? And I would add, particularly in light of, Donald Trump making a whole lot of kind of noise about America, this and that. Do you think that this is a pretty potent message for candidates to put forward?
You know, Michael, I'm a little biased, but I absolutely
yes,
think
I
so.
Do.
I think yes. what you just described, those photo ops, doing it that way, that sounds like I find that a really compelling approach to talking about economic transformation. I like that a lot. I'm a little bit of a policy nerd, so I'd love to see them throw in some of the statistics. You know, you've got some great numbers, like employee owners have 92% greater net household wealth than non-employee owners.
That's a good one.
Employee owners have 53% greater job tenure than non-employee owners. Both of those numbers, by the way, are looking at millennials from a federal data set from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Mm. And millennials are the people you'd expect to have the smallest benefit from being employee owners. But, you know, they also have more flex time. They're more likely to have parental leave. They're three times as likely to have tuition reimbursement through their companies. They're more likely to be involved in decision making. So, I mean, to a point you raised before, it's not just about dollars. Being an employee owner is an educational and a transformative experience because, I mean, let's go back to Marx. most people are alienated from their businesses. They work and they don't have any connection to what's created or the profit or the success of the business. If you're an employee owner, not only do you intimately understand how your business works, what your role is, and how you affect the success of yourself and the success of all your colleagues, you also have more training, more involvement, more responsibility to be a steward for your business.
Well, let me just say, Lauren, you are a very good salesperson, because obviously Marx and alienation is exactly the way to brand this to somebody like me in this audience. It's funny because, I mean, first of all, seriously, yes. In fact, I absolutely think a conversation about, you could talk about, well, you certainly should talk about Marx and alienation, but you could also talk about, in fact, connecting these issues to a much broader set of crises and questions that people have right now about powerlessness, about a sense of lack of meaning, about not only the objective crises of wealth concentration and inequality and, you know, the economy working for such a narrower set of the population, which is a huge crisis in real and material terms. But I think you're absolutely right, too. There's also just this huge sense of so much elimination of human capacity in so many regards. And when you empower people like this kind of across the board, it allows people to be much more of who they are. And that means expressing a lot more capacity and talent, and then also having more actual power. So therefore they have, you know, more resources and better lives. And, you know, that I like that synthesis you're putting together there.
Thank you. And when people come to our conferences, you know, we have CEOs come to our conferences, but we have a lot of non-management people come to our conferences, and what they say really fits exactly what you just said, Michael. It's people feel that they've been able to take more, forgive the phrase, but more ownership over their own lives because of what they've learned by being an employee owner.
Well, that's great. Lauren Rogers, Executive Director of the National Center for Employee Leadership. The piece that we're referencing was in The New Republic, An Economy in Waiting, Fighting Inequality by Turning Workers into Owners by John Case. I'll also mention, we're actually going to play some Richard Wolff in the second half of the show, but look up Mondragon as an example, and definitely read the article and check out all of the work that Lauren is doing with his team at the National Center for Employee Ownership. Lauren Rogers, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Michael.
Appreciate it.
Take care.
All right, folks. Well, Matt, it's just us now.
It's like the old days.
How do you think we're doing?
Oh, it's, this is old hat at this point.
This is old hat. We're still like a lean, mean fighting operation. I guess Brendan and Sam are off to Netroots.
Train journey to Philly.
It's so
I think
funny.
I actually don't know how they get there. But what's so funny?
Taking an Uber. Just funny to think, because Sam used to do all these solo trips. Now he's got like a little travel buddy.
Right, yeah.
He's like, come on, Brendan, let's go.
Brendan's got the right disposition for that, I think.
Brendan is totally a Jeeves in that situation. Without
New Jersey
a doubt.
Jeeves?
He's New Jersey Jeeves.
He's not going to like that.
Going to be fucking assisted, sir. okay, calm down. Like Sam's a very agitated Wooster. Jeeves, no! That's going to be a problem, Jeeves. Do you see? Oh, my God. Between that, and I'll just say this, I don't know what we're going to do with it, but the Haim Saban IDF Power Rangers bit that we were cooking up earlier.
Don't give that away.
All right. That's it.
You can't steal that. We'll sue
you. We will sue on that.
I will sue you to death.
We'll sue everybody. Become a member of
I'll sue you faster than an IDW free speech lawyer.
Does that mean you already pre-prepared the summons?
Yeah, exactly.
The notice is already ready for whoever takes. No, so yeah, seriously, we're working on that. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member, That's how this show works. That's how we give you all the coverage we give you. That's how this whole operation runs. You know why you should support it. Check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade, tea, coffee, or chocolate. Today was the debut of The Quickie with Sam and Laura Steiner.
I listened to it.
Yes. This is, you're going to like this. You're going to want tight 4-minute primer.
Yeah, share it with your normie friends, too.
Share it with your normie friends. Definitely a good way of them to sort of ease them into the Majority Report universe. We had a really fun time on TMBS last night. We always do. But Emma Viglin was in. We did an in-depth dive on the Hong Kong protests. We actually, the shout-out was on part of the movement arising out of the resistance to Standing Rock was city councils, including Kashama Sawant in Seattle, pushing to put to direct municipal money into the creation of state banks like the one in North Dakota, which could be a very significant progressive goal.
The Bank of North Dakota is where I got my loan to go be a fact checker in London for a summer.
That is so cool. That is really quite an impressive institution.
Very happy to pay that one off, actually.
Right.
I'm not even joking. When I submit the payment for that, I'm like, you know what? Fair enough.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And then incredibly fun post game. A lot that we covered. This weekend, we did a think tank session with the crew, an extended crew, Vic Viana. Next week, we're recording with a Sudanese activist. And then Joshua Kahn is returning to the studio with more discussion on First Peoples activism, the climate crisis, and also practical tools for organizing. He's the one who did the Simpsons episode with us on how to build a movement from the bottom up.
Joshua Kahn knows answers to a lot of questions that I think leftists have common anxiety about. Is
yes.
Very straightforward ways of approaching things. Like, how do we do the practice and praxis? And I'll do what Joshua knows.
Joshua knows and has been doing it for over a decade, from the Philippines to Arizona, from Fiji to Colombia. So become a patron, patreon.com/TMBS. Definitely subscribe to the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. We have a huge amount of clips up there now on everything from the anniversary of the Honduras coup to how the left should talk about technology in the future. Obviously, ongoing coverage of all things Brazil, the political imprisonment of Lula. We're really cooking with that. Over 55,000 subscribers now on YouTube, which now we're not even a year in on YouTube. And I think that's solid.
Yeah, but go subscribe to this if you're listening, especially
definitely.
On YouTube, because we want to get to 100K before the end of the year. I think
yes.
It's doable.
I think it is doable. So that's our
even
goal.
Though YouTube's doing some funny business.
Even though YouTube is not friendly.
If you can hear us now,
real creators.
They failed to obscure our art.
Matt, what's going on? I was starting to listen to the Rutger Bregman episode of Literary Hangover. Fascinating.
Yep, we go into Rutger Bregman. I think that is, I think the Antifada has the more farther extreme left part covered, so I thought with this episode we'd discuss more of the Keynesian reformist Sockdem pie in the sky folks versus the us
fucking sellout,
the Marxist realist revolutionaries. But Rucker Bregman has an instant synthesis of a lot of these things, and I think they're I am suspicious of UBI, and so we go into some of our suspicions of that, but I think Bregman's one of the better messengers of it. If Yang was just messaging like Rucker Bregman was about UBI, I wouldn't have much beef with Andrew Yang, but he's not.
If Yang was going across the country saying, in addition to Medicare for all and expanding the social safety net, we should have a UBI program. I mean, what's funny is enough is that
Not bad on some of that stuff.
Like, he's not bad on some of that stuff.
He'll support, like, the student debt cancellation.
Yeah, I think he's, yeah. I think if he just was straight across the board, though, pretty much, like, this should just be an add-on. I mean,
yeah.
What's funny is that one of the things that Lula successfully implemented was arguably a form of UBI, which Bolsa Familia is a cash transfer. And the only condition was is that you got your kids immunized and put them in school.
Damn.
And then families just got money. And that did a lot. But it was part But the distinction I'd add is that this was a government that was investing in social services across right. the board, in expanding healthcare, in college and university construction, literally building hundreds of new universities. So it was part of basically a broad Keynesian effort in a developmentalist model. So it was, and it was a huge success. If a neoliberal government came along and said, we're going to do a less generous bolsa familia and then slash everything else, I would have a major problem with that.
Right.
As part of that overall structure, it was a huge success. I mean, it's one of the reasons that the Workers' Party under Lula took between, in the super conservative metric, 20 million, I would say more accurately 30 or 40 million out of poverty. So, yeah, it's a conversation we should – it's I feel like Kamala Harris. It's a conversation worth having.
Yeah.
It and just shouldn't be at the expense of – food stamps.
Right.
It's just quite obvious, strong
yeah,
example.
Piss off. What are you doing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, or run as a Republican.
Or run as a, right.
Or independent or something. But yeah, you gotta.
There'd be a lot of value. Oh, no, I actually, it'd be, that'd be actually really interesting.
It'd be kind of scary and kind of interesting.
It'd be frankly. Scary and interesting, but maybe good if you could inject some of that stuff.
Yeah. So check that out. Literary Hangover, folks.
Literary Hangover. And also, there's a great bad catalog with, Orwell and all sorts of stuff. All right, folks, we'll see you in the fun half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook. Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.